50 years ago, the French and Germans signed a treaty that ended centuries of hostile rivalry between the two nations and ushered in a new era. So, what's the state of Franco-German relations today? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll discuss the evolution of Franco-German relations with French Ambassador to the U.S. François Delattre and German Ambassador to the U.S. Peter Amon. They'll be speaking tonight at Iowa State University. Then, in the second half hour, anthropologist Robert Franciscus of the University of Iowa. He'll explain new findings hinting that Neanderthals did not coexist with modern humans as long as previously thought. That's all coming up this hour, right after a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Nations, like people, have relationships, and those relationships also go through their ups and downs. Nothing illustrates that more clearly than the relationship between France and Germany. My guests this half hour are François Delattre, the ambassador of France to the United States, and Peter Amon, the ambassador of Germany to the United States. They join us by phone today. Ambassadors, welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
We want to mention that the two of you are guests of Iowa State University today. Tonight, together, you will discuss the European crisis and how your two countries are working on these and other issues at a lecture tonight at Iowa State University at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. The event is free and open to the public. The title of your talk, 50 Years of French-German Friendship. Before we talk about an important anniversary. It is the 50th anniversary of the Élysée Treaty, a treaty that built a partnership between your two countries. I wonder if the two of you could take us back to what we might refer to as the bad old times between your two countries. My European ancestors emigrated to the United States from Alsace-Lorraine, a piece of land that your countries fought over for decades, perhaps even centuries. I wonder if you could take us back to help us imagine the intense animosity that existed between your two countries during the first half of the 20th century and before, to give us a sense of that historically.
Well, let me give it a shot first. This is Peter Amon speaking, the German ambassador. I think it's hard to imagine today how people felt, let's say, only 100 years ago about Alsace-Lorraine, where your parents and grandparents came from, Ben. And I sometimes think that even today, we see conflicts in the world like the conflict in Palestine and other places where people think there's no hope. Let these people, we will never find peace. And what we have seen in Europe is a clear, that it proves that there can be reconciliation. And today, Germany and France are best friends.
Ambassador Delattre, can you tell us a little bit more, what was the basis of that animosity between your two countries before coming together?
I think my colleague and friend, Peter Amon, said it very well. Germany and France have been for literally centuries the arch enemies, you know, in Europe, at the heart of Europe. Since 1870, the two countries fought three wars against each other. And I will give you just an example. At the beginning of World War One, in 1914, during the first day of this war, we French lost 30,000 people in the fight against Germany. 30,000 people in one day. I think this simple figure gives you an idea of the fight that we had between our two countries. And in this respect, reconciliation is a true miracle, to quote former Chancellor Helmut Kohl. This is a miracle that our heads of state and exceptional people from Germany, from France, were able to achieve in the aftermath of World War II. And not only to achieve, but to convince the two peoples in Germany and in France to follow. And today, I think it's fair to say that France and Germany are each other's closest allies and friends and economic partners and cultural partners.
Indeed. And this year marks the 50th anniversary of something called the Élysée Treaty, a treaty that built a partnership between your two countries, France and Germany. signed in January of 1963 between the signatories, French President General Charles de Gaulle and German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. Together, this agreement to work on foreign affairs, economic, military, social issues. What brought these two iconic figures together, de Gaulle and Adenauer, to sign this treaty? What was the necessity of it at this time, 50 years ago?
Well, I believe that at the time, those two leaders had lived through a history of war, like François de Lattre said. War was such a terrible experience to them that they had, in the end, to conclude, we have to do something completely new. And we have to reconcile our two people who had fought for generations. And in the end, the treaty was more than just a treaty. It was, as François said, this was a miracle, which has its effects even today, because it is the basis for European integration and the German-French reconciliation after so many wars. Is the basis of Europe today.
Mm-hmm. It really is amazing. Tell us, what are the lessons, though, from a relationship that goes from intense animosity to a fruitful cooperation over decades? This change, dramatic change, what are the lessons to be drawn from these past 50 years, that relationship that can be perhaps learned in other parts of the world?
Sure. François speaking, François Delat, the French ambassador. I believe the Élysée Treaty very well embodies the European dream. Behind this Treaty of the Élysée, you have, as Peter very well said, the willingness of two exceptional heads of state to reconcile their peoples, to make possible something that seemed just unthinkable a few years ago during the Second World War. That's number one, and it's a miracle in itself. But the second point is that at the same time, the two men plus the others, Schuman, Monet, and a couple of others, wanted to build the European dream. A dream based on peace against war, for sure, a dream based on prosperity, too, and a dream based on the willingness to build a European identity that would be able to exist by itself in on the world stage, to be able to be a global player in today's and tomorrow's world. So this is, I believe, what is important in this treaty, the European dream. And now, behind this treaty, I believe you have a universal message tending to say, yes, even in the bloodiest, most terrible situations, reconciliation is an option. It's possible. And today, when we Americans and Europeans speak to people in the Balkans, we say the same thing. We say, look at what Germany and France were able to do together. So there is hope. There is a chance. When we speak to people in the Middle East, we say the same. We say, look at what the French and the Germans were able to do over the years. So there is hope. Please take your responsibilities. So this Franco-German reconciliation, I believe, and here you recognize the traditional and well-known French modesty, I believe it's a source of inspiration in today's world.
If you've just joined us, my guests this half hour, François de Lattre, you were just listening to Ambassador of France to the United States, Ambassador Peter Amon, Ambassador of Germany to the United States, joining us for a conversation. They'll be speaking tonight at Iowa State University in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. Let's go to today's challenges after reflecting on the past 50 years since that key treaty, ambassadors. Let's have you comment on the key challenges your countries, the European Union, faces today. The top of that list has to be the economic crisis, the European Union's integration. What is at the point of that spear right now as far as what you face in a crisis?
Well, this is Peter Amon, the German ambassador, speaking. I believe that what we have just heard from François, that there's a very deep-rooted will among the Europeans to build a European Union, is quite often underestimated here in the U.S., the euro and the European economic integration is not only a an issue of economic opportunity. It is a very deep-rooted political objective. And as you have seen now in the crisis, where we had to show solidarity with those countries that have were affected by the crisis most, our governments were ready to cough up huge sums of money to stabilize the peripheral country in the European Union. And this can mostly explain by what François just said earlier, that there is a strong political will to build a union, and we will fight for that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your currency, the euro, which has been around for over a decade now. Some observers say that it is criticize it as just a political device used to create unity without much economic value. React to that.
You know, François speaking, the French ambassador, François Delatte, I believe to oversimplify the European integration process, whose engine is really the Franco-German or the German-French friendship and couple, has, so to speak, is like a rocket with three floors. The first floor, is the marché unique.
Single market.
The single market, the zone of free trade, free movement of goods, persons, services. That's number one.
The first stage, and that happened in decades prior.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. The second stage is about the euro, the fact that the euro, which is a teenager, by the way, it's 13 or 14 years old, and has always already been a great success story, promoting growth in Europe, but also promoting American exports and investment to Europe. So that's the second stage, the euro.
Like a teenager, though, creating a little bit of a problem at this time.
Well, but we'll come back to it. The euro is back on the right track, by the way. And the third stage is about the political integration of Europe. How can Europe assert itself on the world stage, be a global player, contribute to, with our American friends, to solve the problems of this world? For example, Europe today contributes to 60% of the world's total development aid, 60%.
In forming the European Union, the term United States of Europe has been used over the years, sometimes as an aspiration, I suppose. I wonder if you could talk about, for our sake, so that we can understand the European Union a little bit more, the ways in which the European Union is like and unlike the United States' union.
Well, the European Union was founded a bit more than 50 years ago. So compare this to the U.S. The United States are more than 200 years old now, and they have gone through a number of crises to build a perfect union. So you are ahead of us in time, so to speak. The European Union is a generational project. And please allow us some time, and I'm sure that my children, my grandchildren, will see a better union in future.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of it also, François speaking, is that Europe and the U.S. have been key to each other's success. We Europeans, and we French in particular, have been instrumental at the birth of the United States of America. And I like to mention Lafayette as the French founding father of your nation. I think it's very fine. Conversely, the United States has been instrumental in making the European integration process possible. In the aftermath of World War II, exceptional Americans were able to conceive the Marshall Plan and therefore to lead Europe to organize itself. And you, Americans, were really at the origin of this European integration process. And we cannot thank you enough for that.
Mm. Yeah, you remind me of Lafayette. As a matter of fact, the studio where I'm sitting, we are on a street behind our studio that is called Lafayette Street.
Oh, good. That's why you are so good.
Talk a little
bit. Throw in Baron von Steuben, who was Washington's chief of staff as well.
Okay, we'll work on a street name for that. Okay,
there we go. There we go.
Now, talk a little bit more, ambassadors, about why the U.S., why we here in Iowa should be so concerned about the economic health of Europe.
Well, we are all concerned about each other's health. And of course, there is a strong interest in each other, because one figure I came across just the other day, which I found surprising, but which I verified, is that, for example, Europe buys four times as much of American exports as China does. So we are a very important economic partner. We Germans have created about 600,000 jobs through direct investment in America. So these are well-paying jobs, by the way. So there must be a strong American interest in continuing trade and investment relationship, and I think we must work on that more. There's talk now about creating something similar to the Trans-Pacific Partnership across the Atlantic. And I just heard your Vice President Biden in Munich speak last week only, where we just debated these ideas. And I think there's so much opportunity ahead of us and so much interest on both sides that we really should work on it.
Mm-hmm. While still a remote possibility, we still hear in the press the talk of a possible, though remote, chance of a breakup of the European Union. Do either of you see this as even a remote possibility?
No,
never. I can tell you that I was quite surprised. I've been here now, ambassador in the U.S. for a year and a half, and I was quite surprised about some reports in the media. People saw the end of the euro every 3 months. Mm. And actually what happened was the best investment people could make last year were to buy Greek bonds. Some hedge funds made a fortune out of that. So it's just the opposite.
You know, François Delatte speaking, the French ambassador, I cannot agree more with my German colleague here. Number one, I think it's very important to realize that the ties between Europe and America are really the backbone, the anchor of the world economy. Together, Europe and the United States will account for close to 50% of the world's GDP, and we are each other's closest economic partner by far. That's number one. I think it's very important to realize that we Europeans and Americans, confronted with a growing economic competition from the emerging world, we have to be together. In other words, the meteoric rise of China, India, Brazil, which is a source of opportunities, of course, for every one of us, brings us closer together. And I will tell you that in the transatlantic dialogue that we have, of course, we deal about the crisis in Mali, where we took the lead, the crisis in Iran, where we took the lead together. But we more and more speak about how do we convince the Chinese, the Brazilians, the Indians to share our vision of intellectual property rights, for example. How do we better fight against social dumping, monetary dumping, environmental dumping coming from these emerging countries, while, of course, trying to increase our ties with these countries? So more and more at the heart of the transatlantic partnership, you have the values that are the core of what we are. You have the strategic national security interest, but you also have the economic interest that we share.
In the closing moments here, I'd like to ask each of you for some personal reflections. I see in looking at your bios that each of you served previously as ambassadors in each other's country as well. I wonder if Peter, Ambassador Peter Amon, can you tell me what you like most about France that you don't have in Germany? And perhaps François Delattre could repay the compliment by telling us what he likes most about Germany that they don't have in France.
Well, the difference between the two countries are still there, but they are slowly disappearing. I think when you move from rural France to rural Germany, the differences would not be so great as they were earlier. But of course, I was in my young days already much impressed by French culture, philosophy, their cuisine, their art of cooking. And these elements, of course, gave me a very favorable view of the country. And I have so many French friends. My children have French friends, so I'm so glad they're there.
Ambassador de Latre, your compliment.
You know, Germany is a country I feel very close to. German is my first foreign language, which I forgot a bit, but still I can catch up. And I was posted to Bonn, Germany from 1988 to 1991 during German reunification. And I still have vivid memories of the fall of the wall, the tears of joy of our German friends, as well as my own. It was an emotional experience that I will never, ever forget.
Have either of you ever visited Iowa before?
Well, this is Peter Ammon speaking. I've been here four times, and I just discovered that there's not another state here in the U.S., apart from Washington, D.C., where I live, of course, that I've visited so frequently.
Really? What, Peter Ammon, if you would go out on the street in your country, what comes to mind? What would people say? What comes to mind when people hear the word Iowa, the name Iowa? What kind of responses do you think you would get if you would ask?
Well, some would say that this is an Indian name. Of course, we all have read the stories about Red Indians, and this has inspired our thinking and fantasy. But I would say you would also meet a number of people in the streets in Germany today that are aware of the huge agricultural potential of the industry you have here, and many have relatives here. So I heard that most Iowans are of German extraction. I think that this is the first, let me say so, ethnic background.
Right.
And quite often you hear people say, well, I have a grandfather who has a cousin that has emigrated here and so on.
Mm-hmm.
For us French, Iowa is really perceived as being at the heart of America, of the America that we so much love over the years. And I will tell you, the only thing that we don't understand is the way you pronounce Des Moines, the Des Moines. And in French, we say Des Moines, of course. And that's the only misunderstanding we have. Otherwise,
okay,
we are exactly on the same line.
Now we have the authority to finally give us the translation of Des Moines. So go ahead, Ambassador de Latre. What does that mean?
Des Moines, actually, it means monks, right? It means monks in French, right? Des Moines.
Okay.
And when you pronounce Des Moines, it's funny for a Frenchman. And this is the third time that I've been in Iowa, and hopefully not the last one.
Oh,
I get invited again.
Very good. We would love to see you again. Ambassador Peter Ammon, Ambassador of Germany to the United States, François de Latre, Ambassador of France to the United States. It's been a delight to talk to you. We want to mention that the two of you will be speaking tonight at Iowa State University. The title of your talk, 50 Years of French-German Relationship, 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. It's free and open to the public. And thank you so much for sharing some time with us. Auf Wiedersehen and au revoir.
Thank you very much, Ben. Auf Wiedersehen.
Thank you very much. Au revoir.
And coming up after a short break, anthropologist Robert Franciscus of the University of Iowa talking about some new evidence suggesting that Neanderthals might not have mingled with humans. Sort of an anti-pre-Valentine's Day story when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And now a pre-Valentine's Day story of sorts, and this one from way, way back. Remember those news reports that Neanderthals and early humans coexisted and perhaps even produced offspring? Well, despite previous data, some new evidence suggests that Neanderthals didn't mingle with humans after all. Joining me to discuss this is Robert Franciscus, professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. Bob Franciscus specializes in Neanderthal studies. Bob, welcome back to our program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's set the scene a little bit before we talk about what's new here in the research that you will talk about. Neanderthals, remind us, who were they? What did they look like? Where did they live?
Right. Well, Neanderthals are among the most well-known of the pre-modern forms of humanity that lived on the Earth before our species arose. Their exact origins are difficult to pin down. Some specialists put it at around 130,000, perhaps up to 200,000 years ago. But there is some possibility that their origins were deeper than that, going back as far as 400 to 500,000 years ago.
Just to give me a picture of this, if a Neanderthal were in the studio with us, maybe I would stand alongside him. I'm about 6 foot tall.
And,
how would we look different?
Right. Well, first of all, you might be surprised to see how short they were. The average Neanderthal male was approximately 5 foot 5 inches tall, probably went around 145 pounds. Females, somewhat smaller, on average around 5 foot one, going around perhaps 120 pounds. But they would have been fairly stocky. They would have appeared to be fairly muscular, although not extraordinarily so, although that is often the way they are pictured as immensely powerful creatures. I think to some degree some of this has been somewhat exaggerated, but they were certainly similar to many hunter-gatherer populations of that body size today, and we're rugged folk for sure.
Bob Franciscus, let's get to the crux of our talk today. There's a new research out that I alluded to in the introduction that may be changing our view of Neanderthals' relationship to Homo sapiens, to humans. What is the new research?
Well, this is a new research that was reported this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It was published by a collaborative international team of Australians, British, French, and Spanish scientists. The lead author was Rachel Wood out of an Australian institute. And what they did was they went back and they reanalyzed a large number of bones, over 200. These are faunal bones that are associated with a series of sites in the Iberian Peninsula. This is largely areas of Spain and Portugal that for a very long time we have thought might have been some of the last homelands of the Neanderthals.
And these were Neanderthal bones?
No, these are faunal bones. In most cases, these are faunal bones that are associated directly with the Neanderthal remains and can be assumed.
Bones of other animals?
Bones of other animals. Mm. In one case, it was the bone of a goat, for example, that was found in stratigraphic association with the Zafiraya mandible. So this is a fairly complete Neanderthal mandible. No question, it's a Neanderthal from the site of Zafiraya in Spain. And, you know, again, for a very long time, we have thought that these dates in particular were very young, around, say, 35,000 years ago if we use corrected radiocarbon dates, calibrated dates. But some of those dates are even younger. For instance, there are sites down in Gibraltar that are putatively as early as 30,000 or even younger than that. And so this has, over the last 10 to 15 years or perhaps a little bit longer, suggested the idea that Neanderthals and modern humans in this part of the world may have coexisted for millennia. For you know, 10,000, 15,000 years, which would, of course, allow at least the possibility of a lot of interaction, including
sure.
genetic interbreeding, you know, interbreeding and producing hybrid populations. Now, the upshot of this new study is they are using a new method. It's a method that uses ultrafiltration that removes some of the contaminants from these bone samples. By the way, the dating is actually done on a part of the bone called collagen. It's a protein found in bone, of course, that is the organic part of bone, not the hard part of bone. And so this method they use is a new technology that removes some of the contaminants that will produce artificially young dates in many cases. And by using this method, what they have determined is that the portion of those 200 bones that they could sample, there's roughly about 11 of them, are considerably older than they had thought.
So that reduces this, what did you say, an overlap from these bones in the Iberian Peninsula from 10,000 years to what? Was there an overlap?
It suggests the possibility, at one end of the possibility, that there was no overlap at all. That is, that the Neanderthals were a dwindling population that essentially was completely gone by the time the modern humans, came into those territories. And, of course, this has profound implications because it suggests that there may have been less of a direct competition between Neanderthals and modern humans for those food resources and other resources that were vital to these populations in that part of the world.
This overthrows the conventional thinking about this that has existed for decades. I mean, how many docudramas or even in dramas have been based on the fact that we go back to some period where there are early humans and Neanderthals coexisting? This could all be a fantasy.
Yes. I mean, we have to be cautious here. The authors of the publication themselves are cautious in their final conclusions. This is the implication, but what they're really calling for is for broader dating of these sites and sites elsewhere in Europe, in the Caucasus, for example, which also have some of these earlier dates, to test this more thoroughly. And they're not ruling out completely the fact that Neanderthals and modern humans might not have interacted, although that is a possibility in terms of their interpretations.
How is the world body of anthropologists receiving this bit of research, this research that could upend so much other theory?
Right. Well, I think like any new study, it's going to be received with a certain amount of skepticism by some. And it's hard to find agreement on any issue when it comes to Neanderthals. I think a lot of individuals will find this compelling and will be comfortable with the idea that the Neanderthals, largely due to climatic deterioration around that time period, were a dwindling population anyway. They were already on the way out. And therefore, one need not have these more dramatic ideas of Neanderthals and modern humans, perhaps in addition to exchanging genes, but being aggressive towards each other possibly and coming into conflict. But then you will have others that would argue that, no, we really need to look at this more carefully. There are problems with any dating methodology. These are a small number of bones, and we have to look at this more carefully because there is other evidence that involves sites that do not necessarily have Neanderthal remains in them.
Mm-hmm.
They may have, for example, tools, which we think were made by Neanderthals, Mousterian tools. The problem is that there's a lot of complexity in the difference between what are typically Neanderthal tools and what are Upper Paleolithic tools, and we even have a sort of intermediate kind of technologies that are sometimes hard to pin down. So just trying to say that Neanderthals were present or not present because of cultural remains is often quite difficult.
Mm-hmm. Will this question, the one raised by this new research, be resolved, be answered in the next 1 or 5 years with other tests that people are creating right now, designing right now, trying to find out?
I'm inclined to think so. The technological increase in sophistication in dating has just been moving along very quickly. And I think we will get better and better dates and more consistent dates probably in the next 5 to 10 years. Moreover, more and more refined genetic analyses are also coming into play here as well. And as we learn more about that and as more Neanderthal and other potentially early modern human, I mean, early modern human fossils give up some of their DNA, we may get more from that sphere of information as well. Now, I don't want to be too hopeful here because the long history of Neanderthal studies has often revolved around this very question. It goes back almost to as long as Neanderthals have been known. And there are compelling reasons to think that we will always have very strong differences of opinion about these dynamics.
Bob Franciscus is my guest, if you've just joined us, a professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa, specializing in Neanderthal studies, explaining to us some evidence that despite previous data, new evidence suggesting that perhaps Neanderthals didn't mingle with humans, or the period in which they could have mingled with humans was actually very, very short. Now, the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology published a sequence of Neanderthal genome in May of 2010. Now, you referred to this earlier because it was discovered that 1-4% of the DNA in modern humans is from Neanderthals. So the explanation for that is not necessarily that the species intermingled?
That is demonstrable evidence that they intermingled. The question actually is when, because let's suppose for the moment that this new study is true, and let's suppose that you did not have intermingling at that time period, at this late time period, say 35,000 years ago. One can posit a scenario where the interbreeding between Neanderthals and modern humans actually occurred earlier. Let's say 50 to 70,000 or 80,000 years ago. And the place that a lot of people think that may have happened is in the Levant. There's a narrow strip in Israel that has produced a large number of Neanderthal and modern human remains from roughly about 120,000 years ago or even earlier down to 40,000 years ago.
So in this earlier time, 70,000 years ago, humans were still as pretty much as they are today, early humans?
Well, no. There have been subtle changes. Human evolution is an ongoing process, and I think it would be somewhat wrong to say they were exactly like us, but in fundamental ways, anatomically, and to some in some ways, at least at the later time period, around 50,000, behaviorally more like modern hunter-gatherers. But this idea allows the possibility of Neanderthal modern human interbreeding, which there certainly was, and still reconcile the fact that we might not have this long period of overlap in the Iberian Peninsula at a later time period.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the referred to what is thought to be the reason that the Neanderthals died out, and we think this is approximately what time? How long ago?
Well, it depends. And if these new data are correct, then the possibility is it may have been 45 or 50,000 years ago rather than 30,000 years ago, which we have been thinking for a long time.
You referred to climate, of course, an issue that we are, as humans on this planet, very concerned with at the moment. What was going on with the climate at that time, be it 30,000 years ago or 50,000 years ago, that would have led to the end of this entire species?
Well, we know that around 70,000 years ago, the climate in Europe took a severe downturn. There had been climatic fluctuations all along. There had been oscillating glacial and interglacial cycles. But at about 70,000, the climate really started deteriorating. It got colder and colder and colder, and you had a full glacial set of conditions by about 20,000. Now, Neanderthals are a cold-adapted population. There's no doubt about that, and we think they may have had loose kind of skin wraps, and they certainly knew how to make fire, and so they had those things to help them. But once the climate really got very cold, let's say where you started developing winter temperatures at where you were getting below 0 degrees Fahrenheit, even Neanderthals with that kind of technology would have had quite a bit of difficulty surviving. The idea is that that modern humans coming into this environment might have had better pyrotechnology or fire kinds of technology.
Building shelters better?
Pr- perhaps some minimal shelters, although we see that for Neanderthals, but things like tailored clothing, which there doesn't seem to be much evidence for Neanderthals. If you have tailored clothing and if that tailored clothing is layered, along with large fires that are, you know, kept going for long periods of time, you can really do a lot more than when you're just running around with fur wraps and very simple surface fires. So this is one idea. Another idea is that to whatever extent the Neanderthals and modern humans were interacting and were competing for resources, there are ideas that they had different kinds of ways of doing that. So, for example, it's been suggested that Neanderthals were really big into what's called close quarter hunting, where they're engaging large dangerous animals with thrusting spears without any real distance between them and these animals. It's even been suggested by some researchers that not only males but female Neanderthals were engaged in this behavior. If modern humans are coming into this region where only males are doing that kind of behavior and they have more sophisticated technology using composite weaponry, for example, that allows them to get some distance between them and the animals, then it's been thought that there would have been far less injuries among the modern humans. Now, I have to say that there's been some recent work on this done by the very person who originated the sort of big, close quarter hunting dynamics based on trauma in Neanderthal bones, the patterns of damage to their bones. And more careful comparison with Neanderthals and early modern humans has tended to blur what was formerly more of a distinction. So there seem to be as many of these upper body injuries in early modern humans as well. Mm-hmm. And that kind of complicates the picture a little bit. But you're going to get a whole spectrum of views in terms of how inefficient or how efficient Neanderthal hunters were compared to modern humans, or indeed their whole suite of technology.
When we talk about their technology or their clothing, their ability to tailor clothing compared to early humans. So we're really talking about the brain right now, the human brain showing its advantages compared to the Neanderthal brain.
That's right, and especially the human brain in a more complicated social context. Social complexity, the idea that it isn't so much the brain of any one individual, but it's a network of brains in, you know, perhaps extended kin network systems that becomes a very, very important kind of dynamic that is difficult to compete with. One manifestation of this that has also been heavily debated is whether or not Neanderthals had symbolic behaviors, for example, art. And so for a very long time, it's been argued by many researchers that compared to modern humans that had abundant evidence for cave art and mobiliary art and other evidence of symbolic behavior.
We know cave paintings go back 30,000 years, don't they?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. And we also find ubiquitous evidence for personal adornment among modern humans.
How do we know those very oldest cave paintings were made by early humans and not Neanderthals?
Well, in fact, in one recent case, also another recent study, some cave paintings in Spain have been dated to some earlier, to very early time periods, around 42,000, that at least in the minds of the people who published this article, allow the possibility that the early examples of that may well have been Neanderthals. Now, if Neanderthals are producing art, and there is increasing evidence for that, we have evidence for decorated shells that may have been used as necklaces. Mm-hmm. We have evidence for other things that look like personal adornment. There's, you may have heard about recent studies that suggest that an abundance of wing bones in birds in Neanderthal sites, which otherwise don't have much meat on them, were really being used to acquire their feathers for sort of adornment via feathers, which we know from ethnographic accounts is what people often do. And so there is this question of to what extent Neanderthals actually engage in symbolic behavior. And if they did, there's another question about whether they came up with that kind of thing on their own because their brains produced it on their own, or whether it was a diffusion process where they actually mimicked or learned that from modern humans. Now, In my mind, it's not really – that's almost a distinction without a difference, because the capacity to learn may be just as important as the capacity to innovate. And I must say that even a few years ago, I was reticent to think much about the possibility that Neanderthals were responsible for symbolic behavior on the sort of scale that we think it is today. But I'm becoming increasingly convinced by these recent discoveries.
So many fascinating insights, fascinating questions that you've raised about the history of early humans, Neanderthals here. We'll have to have you back as we get more updates. Our science gives us more updates, perhaps your own research as well. I wonder if we could end, Bob Franciscus, by having you give us a myth that you'd like to have busted about Neanderthals, since they are your specialty. Yes. At the top of that list, would it be people misunderstanding that we are actually evolved from Neanderthals? We are not.
I think one of the sort of myths of Neanderthals that has been propagated over the last generation or two is an idea of just how physically different they were from ourselves. They almost seem to be caricatures of themselves in some way, so that they are ultra strong, super strong, that they have all kinds of sort of adaptive specializations, including weird kinds of nasal morphology and all kinds of things that suggest that they were really bizarre and behaved in bizarre ways sometimes. I think many of these have actually been overplayed. A lot of these have been based on comparisons only between Neanderthals and urbanized comparative modern populations, rather than direct comparisons with actual early modern humans, where the distinctions are not so different. This is not to say that Neanderthals didn't have their unique aspects of anatomy. Every population has its unique attributes. But I think some of these have been very, very exaggerated, almost to the point of being cartoonish.
Well, Bob Franciscus, your discussion about this topic is matchless. Professor of Anthropology at the University of Iowa, we always enjoy having you join us here on River to River. Thank you very much, Bob.
It's been a pleasure. I hope to see you again.
And that's all for today. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Help from Caitlin Fry and Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.